And Lesson 6, page 13. Starting tonight, and then, Lord willing, on the Sunday and next Wednesday, we will cover three chapters, all dealing with the same judge or deliverer. And what was his name? One of the more well-known of the judges. Gideon. All right. So Gideon's story will take center stage now in our discussions, in our classes. And tonight we're looking at chapter 6. I want to make just a couple of introductory comments. Thank you, Gary. So far, God has used, and this is my term, some weak things. Now, that doesn't mean that they weren't successful, that they weren't useful. But just in terms of how man might view them, He's used some weak things to deliver Israel. In chapter 3 and verse 16, just real quickly, what was it that Ehud used? Yeah, a homemade dagger. It wasn't anything that was particularly special, but it got the job done. Chapter 3 and verse 31, the only verse we have about Shamgar. He used an ox goad, something, just an implement that would have been used to prod along livestock or cattle, oxen. Then in chapter 4 and verses 9 as well as verse 21, what was the weak thing that was used there? And I don't mean this disparagingly, but just in the context of the discussion that was had in that chapter. A tent peg used by a woman. And that doesn't demean women. I'm just saying women did not receive, because as you recall, Deborah's words to Barak were that the honor will not go to you. It'll go to a woman. So God used these things to bring about deliverance for His people. And He's now going to use a man. Would you say that Gideon would show some weaknesses in his story? He will. That doesn't mean that he's not useful. But there are some occasions where Gideon, it doesn't appear, responded as he should. And to close a particular point out, remember the discussion in 1 Corinthians 1? What sort of things does God use to show the foolishness of the world? Foolish things, or things that the world deems as foolish or weak. And particularly in the context, Paul says God uses the preaching of the gospel. Those who think that message to be foolish and silly, that's the very thing God used to bring about redemption for man in his sin. So I think we see a little pattern here that certainly fits in the Bible story, how God, because of who He is and what He's able to do, He can use anything at His disposal. And he did in this day, and He does in our day as well. So that's how we sort of get into the story of a Gideon. All right. Some of our comments tonight will seem redundant. And that's because they are, because of this cycle. Again, what did Israel do as we start the chapter? All right, she was unfaithful to the Lord, did evil in the sight of the Lord, your version may read. It doesn't say in verse 1 that she went and served the Baals. But that's the pattern. Now, that she went and played the harlot. She went and bowed down to the idols, the false gods, and she did evil in the sight of God. First part of verse 1. And true to his form in this cycle, what did God do? Another oppressor. And now, this time, into the hands of who? The Midianites. All right. How long was Israel going to be in the hands of Midian? All right, 7 years, the end of verse 1. I've asked at the end of question 1, historically, who were the Midianites? All right. Historically, we can see from Genesis chapter 25, these were the descendants of Abraham's fourth son by Keturah. Now, obviously, who was Keturah? The second wife of Abraham, of course, after who died? Sarah. After Sarah died, the Bible says that Abraham married Keturah. You can turn to that passage and find the list of the sons that she bore to Abraham. And Midian was the fourth in that. Pardon? Who was the second wife? I could be wrong about that. I thought she was... Well, Hagar, yeah, okay. I wasn't going to count Hagar. That's correct. Now, there you go. You're getting technical on me. Hagar was given to Abraham as a wife. So, change that chart right quick. Well, it doesn't say second wife. That was my comment. His third wife. Thank you, Freddie. So picky. Just so picky. I know. That's right. Okay. So Abraham's wife after Sarah. How about that? Keturah. And Midian was born to that union. And so these peoples are the descendants and And how often do we read of the Midianites in the Old Testament? Several references we find of the people of Midian, usually as the enemies of Israel. Okay. Now we have some information about Midian's oppression that the writer gives us. And as you read these verses, before we look at the specific points, as you read them, how harsh was Midian being on Israel? That's right. I mean, they gave them no room at all. They had no relief from this heavy hand. Verses 2 through 6. In fact, Doug, won't you read verses 2 through 6 for us of Judges chapter 6? No, Doug. Yeah, Doug. So what did Israel have to do just to find some relief? What'd she do for herself? Went into hiding. Had to find some relief in the strongholds or in the caves that were scattered throughout that mountainous area. So that's where they would sort of flee to get away from this hard oppression. But of course they had to live. They had to eat, so they would sow their crops. But how was that affected by the Midianites? All right, whatever it was sown, they'd come in and take it, either for themselves or just destroy so the Israel couldn't have it. I mean, either way, it was going to be hard on Israel. Again, how were they described, the Midianites as well as their animals? Like what? Like locusts. Well, how devastating are locusts? This total annihilation. Leave nothing behind. Right, absolutely. Right. That's indicated by verse 5. Yes, they would come up with their livestock and their tents. They would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came to the land devastated. So they just left nothing behind for Israel. And also I get the idea that they left no livestock for Israel. The end of verse 4. They would leave no sustenance in Israel as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. So, took away their crops, their food, took away their livestock. God was really putting the oppression on Israel because of her sin. So, that brings about the next step in the cycle. What was Israel forced to do eventually? Cry out to the Lord. As they had been doing in the previous cycles. So, as a result, they cry out to God. True to form. So, we have evil, we have disobedience, idolatry. God responded similarly by sending them off into oppression, and then you see the record of how bad it was for Israel, and again, true to form, Israel would cry out for help. Now, we have a change in the cycle here. God's response. Look at verses 7 through 10. Let's read that. Scott, read those verses for us, please. The Judges chapter 6, verses 7 through 10, please. Scott Abernathy. That through verse 10? Okay. I got distracted there for a minute. Sorry about that. All right, so here's God's response. Now, do you see anything different this time than what has happened the previous judges? Yes. That's right. First off, what did God not do? At least He hadn't done it yet. There's no deliverer sent yet. You go back and you read the first judges, the first cycles of oppression, when Israel would cry out to God, the record states what's next. God would send the judge. God would send the deliverer. And then there would be redemption. But this time, that doesn't happen. God sends a prophet, an unnamed prophet, instead of a judge. And He sent a prophet to explain some things. Is an explanation necessary? Now, we're not going to second-guess God. But why would God have thought an explanation would be necessary? Okay, I think it's the theme of the book. But that's right. They keep committing the same sin over and over again. The results aren't getting any different. It's the same problem time after time. So, as a good parent will do sometimes to a disobedient child who shows some tendencies, maybe to keep doing some of the same things, what's good parenting? Well, let's have a talk about this. Let me, again, and this may be for another time, but let me tell you why you're having some of the difficulties that you are. That's exactly right, Brother Lambert. Not only did He explain the problems, but He explained the blessings from the past. So, He reminded Israel of His deliverance from Egypt. Now, that goes back to the record in Exodus, obviously. Moses bringing them out of captivity, bondage. Verse 9, He mentions again, from the hands of the Egyptians and from the hands of all your oppressors, and dispossessed them before you and gave you their land, referring to the Canaanites, correct? In the days of who? That's right, Joshua, after Moses. So He reminds them of that. And then He also says, and I said to you, verse 10, He also reminds them what? Yeah, I am the Lord your God, and I don't want you to be afraid of these localized idols that these Canaanites are worshiping. You don't need to fear them. You don't need to be impressed by the things that are being ascribed to these gods as they have the power of this, that, or the other thing. He said, I don't want you to be impressed by that at all. You've always had plenty of reason to believe in me and be faithful to me. But the last phrase that God says in verse 10 is what? All these reminders of truthful things, but you haven't done it. You have disobeyed me time and time again. He rebuked them for their repeated disobedience. And so here we have this explanation. No deliverer. He gives them an explanation, a rebuke, if you will, for their repeated disobedience. So I think there's an important point to learn here. It seems to me that God wanted Israel to understand that her present predicament was more important to understand than what? What did she want? She wanted relief. That's right. Now, is God going to bring relief? Eventually, yes. But at the start, He wants them to understand, maybe it's better that you know what your real problem is than if I just give you relief, because as the pattern has been, once relief came, they go right back to it again. And so it seems that God's trying to get at the root of the problem rather than just in the present predicament or the present problem. So, again, I think this is a fair question. Sometimes, isn't it right that understanding the problem is more important than eliminating it? Wouldn't that be so? If you just remove the problem, like a Band-Aid. Well, take, for example, Pharaoh. Now, I know he wasn't a child of God. But when God brought those curses upon Egypt, and Moses would give that cry, thus says the Lord God, let my people go. And if you don't, you're going to suffer these hardships. And so Pharaoh would dig his heels in and not let them go. And so that God would bring the plague. But what would Pharaoh do? Go talk to your God and say what? I will, if you take away this plague, I'll let them go. The difficulty would be removed. Life not hard anymore. He would harden his heart. See, all he cared about, he didn't really care about doing right. All he wanted was what? Relief. That's all he wanted. And in this case, it seems that God's making a similar point. I want you to understand, Israel, what the real problem is, and that's more important that you see that than you getting relief from what you're what you're crying out for. So that's why God sent this prophet, and he did not send the deliverer just yet. None of the same people have been. Yes, right. As Freddie points out, this is happening in different areas. It's the same problem as far as God's concerned. But this area will be affected by the Midianites. This area will be affected by the Moabites, by the Amalekites. And so that is true. But as far as God's concerned, it's all one big problem. It's unfaithfulness. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's a good point, Gary. The problem is not the oppression. The problem is not the hardship. The problem is unfaithfulness and disobedience. And so any good engineer will tell you, okay, we have this problem in this mechanized process. Well, before we start yanking things out or putting things in, what do we have to know? Where's it going wrong? What's the matter with it? And so that's a good analogy from our engineering brother over there who's involved in that kind of work. Okay. Yes. Yes. Well, okay. Maybe so. Okay, so now we come to verse 11 and we get our first glimpse of Gideon. This is where we start talking about the man. And this takes us to question 4. So, who was it, Gideon? How was he described to us in the chapter? All right, he's the son of Joash, the Abiezrite. All right, what do we know about his kinfolk? Well, where did they live? They lived in Ophrah. Now, if you get a map out, all map of scholars will say typically Ophrah was in Issachar. And if you get a map that shows the dividing of the tribes, if you look in Issachar's region, you'll see the dot of Ophrah. But was Gideonite an Issacharite? He lived there. He was not from Issachar. He was from Manasseh. We know that for two reasons. Look at verse 15, skipping ahead just for the minute. When he's talking to the Lord or the Lord's angel, and the Lord told him what his job was going to be, he said, "Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh." And also, Joshua 17 and verse 2 tells us some information about the family of Joash, how it did come from Manasseh. So, even though he's from Manasseh, apparently they're now just living in Issachar, in the city of Ophrah. That really shouldn't cause any difficulty, but just technically speaking, that's information given to us in the text. Now, what was Gideon doing as he's introduced to us in this chapter, and why was he doing it? All right, he's threshing wheat, beating out some wheat where? All right, what was a wine press? Is it like a big vat or a hole in the ground in some cases with a wooden or a stone fence or a wall? And they would dump the grapes in there, and they would tread them out by foot. They would press the juice out of the grapes. So it was sort of not just out in the open ground, but it was sort of concealed a little bit. And Gideon used that, beating out the wheat in the wine press, for what reason? Keep the Midianites, because again, how was it described early in the chapter? They'd take anything they found. So Gideon was trying to hide this wheat for himself and his family, perhaps, so that they could live and keep it from the Midianites. So he's doing this secretly, just to survive. He's in preservation mode here, basically, to keep food for himself and for his family. Well, we're going to see some efforts now, verses 12 through 24, as we'll look at together. They're trying to reassure Gideon, it's going to be an attempt to reassure him or to give him confidence. So he's in the wine press, verse 11. And then it says in verse 12 that the angel of the Lord, or it could be the Lord himself, it was a theophany, the Lord appearing through, maybe some kind of an angelic manifestation. The Lord is with you. What? Mighty man of valor, or some would say, oh, valiant warrior. This man of valor or this mighty warrior, the Lord is with you. Well, that's just what was told Gideon. First response, what did Gideon think of that statement? I don't think I agree with that. He's got some doubts about that. And he states them, doesn't he? So he was addressed as a valiant warrior, mighty man, and he was promised that God's with you. And God's not forgotten about you. And Gideon, he was not reassured. So what is he reason? Look at verse 13. Oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us. Now, if it's what you say it is, then why then has all this happened to us? What's the next thing he mentions? And that tells us what had happened in the past. He had been told those stories. Because obviously he wasn't around when they came out of bondage. He didn't see those miracles. But where's all those miracles? Where's all those deliverance signs and wonders that have been told and taught to our people, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? I don't see that happening. And then his closing statement is what? What do you mean with us? He's abandoned us. My version says, or he's forsaken us. It's just the opposite. So Gideon, it appears on the face here, he wasn't buying this. This is how he felt. Now, the words of the Lord in verse 12, aren't they true? The Lord's with you. Yes, it's true. God's not going to tell a lie. But as far as Gideon was concerned, he didn't see any evidence of the fact that God was with him. In fact, he accused God of abandoning his people or forsaking. Now, is there some level of truth? Had God forsaken them into the hands of Midian? But had he totally forsaken them? No, he had not totally done that. Because he's going to bring them out through the hands of this man. Now, say that again now. Okay, maybe so. Freddie's point is, as we look at the stories as they occur in order, there's no indication that Gideon knew about the previous deliverance, say, of Ehud from the king of Eglon, or Eglon, king of the Moabites. And so he wouldn't have had any... Now, he may have known, but we don't have any record to know that he did know or that information was shared. That, again, could have a bearing on the story itself. Yes. All right. That's a good point, too. God tells him what he is in his sight, and that's exactly what he is. And so that is a statement of confidence, if you will, Brother Lambert. I think that's a good point to make. That's how God thought about it. So these efforts are being done to reassure Gideon. So God responds. Look at verse 14. Go this and in your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you? Gideon, I've picked you. You're my man. Well, in the past, when God has picked a man for a job, has there been some resistance? Moses gave some resistance at the burning bush. He gave all those, we have come to call them excuses. Well, what sort of excuses does Gideon list here in the next verse? He says, look, my family is least in Manasseh. And even more than that, I'm least in my family. Both of these will be, I think they'd be physical criteria, wouldn't they? What's that got to do with it? If God picked this tribe from which to bring the deliverer, and if God picked this man, that doesn't mean a thing. Remember, he's already used the ox goad, and he's used the tent peg in the hands of a woman. This is God's choice. It's fully able to do the job. What Gideon needs here is what? He needs faith. That's right. He needs faith. That if God says something, then it must be so. It must be true. And I've got to have enough faith to believe Him and then take my place in His plan and fulfill that. So he wanted more reassurance. Gideon did. Verse 17, what was his proposal? All right, he says, verse 17, if I have found favor in thy sight, then please show me a sign that it is thou who speakest with me. What was the sign that Gideon proposed? What did he say? It's not the fleece yet. Yeah, let me make an offering to you. This is verse 18. He says, please do not depart from here until I come back to thee and bring out my offering and lay it before thee. Let me present an offering to you and don't go. You stay right here. Let me go get it and I'll bring it back. And what did the angel of the Lord say? I won't go. So he stayed. So Gideon goes and what's he prepare? All right, he goes and prepares a kid or a goat with unleavened bread. He brings it back, and he was instructed then, place the meat and the bread on this rock along with the broth. Is that correct? Pour the broth out on the rock, verse 20. And so he did. Puts it there in front of the Lord. Then what happens next? Here's the sign. Well, first the angel did what? There was a staff in his hand, and he takes the staff and touches the sacrifice, the meat or the bread, or just touches the rock where it's being offered, and fire comes up from the rock, correct, and consumes the whole thing. And then what happens? He disappears vanishes from Gideon's sight. So this is engulfed in fire as if to indicate that the Lord accepted it. It is offered up in fire. And then the angel or the Lord, this manifestation, vanishes from Gideon's sight. Well, how did Gideon react to that? All right. The angel vanished. And Gideon was afraid that he had seen inappropriately, or he had seen a forbidden manifestation of the verse 22. For now I have seen the angel of the Lord face to face. And he knew well enough to know that I'm not permitted to do that. I've got a big problem here. What was the immediate reassuring statement from God? Verse 23. You won't die. Do not fear, Gideon. You're not going to die. This was entirely acceptable to the Lord that this take place. So all these things are being done initially for what purpose? To reassure Gideon. I have chosen you. Yes, times do look bleak. It's obvious that I understand exactly how you feel from what he said earlier and how things look to the people. But I've got big plans for you. And I need you to be on board with me on this thing. And I need you to be fully ready to take your place. But you're going to have to trust me. You're going to have some confidence here. All these things are being done for Gideon personally. Absolutely. Faith's got to come. Yes. Can God give you your faith? He can help you, but that's got to come from you. You've got to have enough belief and enough confidence that if God says something, no matter how things may look as bleak as they are, it's going to happen. Yes, faith is based on what He said. That's correct. All right. So, God reassured him he's not going to die, and he named the place then Yahweh Shalom. Or translated means what? That's verse 24. The Lord is peace. I think that's the standard Hebrew greeting, isn't it? Shalom. Peace be to you. So that is where that comes from. So to this day, as the record is being written, verse 24, this altar or this place was called that in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Okay. So that was done to gain Gideon's confidence. Now the mission starts. Here's the first instruction for Gideon. And as you read verses 25 through 32, this part of the story, how difficult was this going to be? Was this going to be easy? This would not be easy. But it had to be done. That's right. And opposition that's going to start where? At home. Make an application that's just in a moment. So he was told, the Lord tells Gideon, the same night, take your father's bull. My version says, and a second bull. I'm not sure all the versions read that way. Okay. Some translations indicate that it was the same bull, but be that as it may, whether it's one or two. Take the bull and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father. And also something else. Cut down the grove or the Asherah, and that's beside it. And that's interesting. Like, for example, when you read of the story of the battle on Mount Carmel, sometimes you'll see this phrase in the Old Testament, the prophets of the grove. The Old King James has the word grove here. The Asherah, or the Asherim, which was the female part of the Baal identity, were nothing more than trees that had the tops of them lopped off. And they were just basically just trunks set up there. Well, yes, and in the trunk they would carve the images of the Asherah or the Asherim. But they were called the grove because they would come from trees that had been hewn down or cut down. That's where that phrase comes from. It's what I've read. So anyway, he says, you go to your father's house, you cut these down, and he's going to offer this bull. Well, where's he going to get the wood for the fire? That's the Asherah. You use these logs or these poles. You want firewood. Right there's firewood. You're going to burn that wood, offer up the bull in an altar of worship to me. And you're going to pull Baal down. Now, how's that going to go over in the town? Not good. And in his own house in addition to that, Brother Lambert, you're correct. So Gideon did this at night. This is question, last part of question 7. Is there anything indicated or recorded that might indicate Gideon's level of courage at this? All right. Look at the phrase, last part of verse 27. Mine says it came about that because he was too afraid of his father's house and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night. Now, did God indicate when, what time of day he was to do it? There's no indication of that. That was the general command. Gideon, he obeyed, but he used his own wisdom. I don't have enough courage to do this during the day. We're going to do it at night. And thus he did. Well, he thought it best to do it at night, use the cover of darkness to sort of conceal who he was. He was fully intent on doing what God said to do, but he just didn't have enough courage, enough faith to do it right out in the daytime and let whatever consequences come. The expedient way he deemed would have been doing it at night. You're correct. Well, I want to make an application here. We'll do this real quickly. I believe these instructions to Gideon, particularly regarding his father's idol to Baal, underscore what I'm calling a bedrock principle that was also taught by Jesus. Particularly in Matthew 10, what did Jesus say? And he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Gideon had to take a stand here against his own family. Is that still happening today? If you want to obey the Lord, and a person comes in contact with the gospel, and he hears the truth, or she hears the truth, whoever it may be, and it goes against even what one's own family religion is, you going to have a tough road to hoe? You might. Now, not necessarily you will, but in most cases, you might. You most certainly could. And what are you going to have to finally come to grips with? It's got to be God's way. Yes, I love my mother and my father and my wife and my husband and my children or whoever it may be, but I've got to love God more. Yes, absolutely. So I see a similarity here in what God told Gideon and what Jesus tells us in the New Testament. Faith has got to be that strong that you're even willing to go against your own family if you're going to please God. And, of course, Gideon did. Well, it comes about the next day that the men of Ophrah, I wonder how they found out. The Bible doesn't say. But it just indicates that eventually it was discovered. Well, it was Gideon, the son of Joash, that did this. However it was determined, it came out. And so what do the men of Ophrah do? Well, they go to Joash and they say what? Bring your boy out here. We're going to kill him for what he's done to Baal. He's responsible. We're going to execute him right out here in the square. Well, what did Joash say? This is a logical thing to say. Now, is there any indication that Joash was unhappy with Gideon and what he'd done? It doesn't say it in the text. It was his idol, it was his image, and his own son did this, but there's no indication that Joash was displeased with Gideon. He just simply says, he argues from the standpoint, well, look, if Baal's a god, let Baal contend for himself. In fact, he even went one step further. The last part of verse... the middle part of verse 31. Whoever will plead for Baal shall be put to death by morning. You just let the situation alone, and let's see what Baal does about it. I thought that was a sensible thing to say. If someone has torn down his altar, then let Baal do that. So on that day, verse 32, how did the situation change? What was Gideon's name now? Jerubbaal, which means, as it's translated, let Baal contend against him. Perhaps some may see this as Joash putting Gideon under somewhat of a curse. Could be. Let Baal fool with him. And if Baal be real or true, which of course he wasn't, but if in their minds he was, then if Baal sees fit to take Gideon's life, then so be it. So he changed his name or called him from that time on Jerubbaal. Let Baal contend against him. All right. Well, verses 33 through 35. Now we start to see the battle lines start to take shape, don't we? We see the coalition mentioned in verse 33. Midianites, the Amalekites, and the sons of the east, they assemble themselves, and they cross over and camp in the valley of Jezreel. Verse 34 says what? Jezreel is north in Manasseh, or if sometimes, depending on the map how it's drawn, it's even southwest in Issachar, up in that area. Well, how does the text describe the other side? It says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. Now, we'll see that phrase a lot in the book of Judges with respect to who? In the coming chapters. Samson. See it many times with respect to Samson. So God's Spirit came upon Gideon, and what's he do? He blows the trumpet, verse 34, and the Abiezrites were called together to follow. So that's his family. He gets his family, but who else does he get? He gets Asher, Manasseh, Zebulun, and Naphtali. So he draws together a coalition of forces. So the sides are drawn now. The battle lines are drawn. Now, in the next chapter, of course, what happens with this group that he's got put together here? What's the problem? Is God going to accept that army? That's too many. Too many. And so we'll talk about that story on Sunday. Too many men. And we'll deal with that on Sunday. But God says, that's too many. I don't want that many. But anyway, Gideon gets the forces together. So that's the actions in those verses. And then finally, he seeks more reassurance, Gideon does. And the closing minutes of our class tonight, verses 36 through 40. The battle is imminently before him. He once again wants more reassurance. So what sign now does he ask of God? Okay, I'm going to put a piece of fleece or wool on the threshing floor, on the ground. And in the morning, what sign did he want? Dew only on the fleece and all the ground around it, dry, bone dry. And what's God do about that? Yes, he does. How much dew did he get out? Mine's at a bowl full. I don't know how big his bowl was, but it was a container. He could wring out or squeeze out enough dew that it filled some size of a container, a bowl. Well, what about the next day? Give me the reverse sign. To confirm the confirmation, he requested a reverse sign. Dew on the ground all around the fleece, while the fleece remained dry. Again, God did as he requested. What is the natural thing for wool to do with moisture? It's going to soak it up. And so God's going to intervene and not let the fleece soak up all that moisture. It would be completely dry on the ground, and it was. And so that was the confirmation. This was not a necessarily absence of faith, I don't believe. Not necessarily. Could have been, but not necessarily. God's ready to use man even when man has weak moments. And God's going to do what He can to strengthen the faith of man. So these signs here, particularly as the chapter concludes, were aimed to, again, prove to Gideon what important point. I'm with you, Gideon. You can do this. I've empowered you to do this great work. And once that takes place, then man is able to use the strength that God gives him to accomplish that particular task that God is assigning him. And that will take place in the next few chapters. Okay. Thought question for us to consider. How can we know that God's with us today? How do we know that? That's what Gideon needed to know. When we abide in His Word, passages like 2 John 9, texts from the Gospel of John tell us that if we want to know that God's with us, we must abide in His Word. If we don't abide in His Word, then what? He's not. Well, we're lost, but He's not with us. He won't be with us. Very important point. Okay, let's stop there.